This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The top stories. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah vows an appropriate response to any Israeli attack, saying Hezbollah will show the regime a different strategy in the future. People take to the streets in Italy, France, and Cyprus to protest against the mandatory COVID-19 vaccine passports required for entering public places. Also in headlines, Brazil registers over 43,000 new cases of the novel coronavirus and 990 deaths from the disease.
Welcome to the program.
Hezbollah chief Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has pledged an appropriate response to any Israeli attack. The secretary general of the Lebanese resistance movement noted that Hezbollah noted or needed to quickly respond to the Israeli attack of Lebanese lands on August the 5th in order to maintain the deterrence power. Mariam Saleh has more.
The secretary general of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, said that the recent Israeli attack was a very dangerous development, which has not occurred in the last 15 years, stressing that the resistance needed to respond swiftly.
Our response was linked directly to the two incidents of Israeli Air Force attacks, which targeted Lebanese territory for the first time in 15 years. And our response had very clear tools and objectives. We calculated our moves very precisely. Our enemy and our friends said this. They said open territory. They did not target civilians. So we also targeted open areas with no civilians. But we had many options. We could hit open areas in Sheba Farms, in northern occupied Palestine, or the occupied Golan Heights.
Said Hassan Nasrallah made the remarks in a televised speech to commemorate the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war. He said that Israel deliberately targeted open areas in the middle of the night in order to terrorize civilians and presumed that the resistance would not respond because of the various domestic problems inside Lebanon. Said Nasrallah stressed that the main deterrence for Israel is the capabilities of the resistance.
The enemy today is more fearful than any time in the past because of the developments in Palestine and the region and the transformations in the region and the ascending strength of the resistance and because of the deep internal divisions and the mutual hatred between the occupying Zionist groups. Facing their internal issues and the strengthening of the resistance, everyone in the Zionist entity is talking about an existential threat.
Experts believe the military potential of Hezbollah has created a balance of deterrence where Israel is incapable of even starting a war.
Israel wants Hezbollah to start the war. The situation will be different. Hezbollah is aware of this, will not Israel let him go to war, you know, anytime Israel wanted.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance noted that in any future confrontation, the Israeli military will disintegrate completely and would be heavily defeated. The 2006 war had settled a certain status quo, which remains until today, with a new regional equation, which comprises all the resistance groups in the region. Any miscalculation by the Israelis could be detrimental for Israel. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Political commentator Karim Sharara says if Hezbollah had not responded in time to Israel's latest attack, the operation would have lost all sense of meaning.
As for this retaliation, this was a time-sensitive operation because if they had not retaliated, then the operation would have lost all sense and the resistance would not have been able to make the impact that it made today. The Israeli media, I mean, some commentators, they got the idea that because the two groups that performed this retaliation were named after the two martyrs, that, well, this, by this operation or by this retaliation, then Hezbollah would have actually taken vengeance, so to speak, against these, for the Israeli attacks. No, this is not it, as Sayed Hassan stated. That score has not been settled yet. This is merely a retaliation against the airstrikes, but naming the two groups after these two martyrs was just to keep their memory alive and to remind the Israelis that we have not forgotten about these two martyrs and we will retaliate as soon as the opportune moment comes.
Tensions have been simmering in West Asia over the past few days after Israel and Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah exchanged fire. Lebanon has slammed the Israeli escalation, saying the regime's aggressive intent is in violation of international law. This is while Israel has violated Lebanese airspace throughout the years.
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has fired dozens of rockets at open areas around the Israeli-occupied Sheba farms. In a statement, Hezbollah said it hit open fields near Israeli positions at 11:15 a.m. local time Friday using dozens of 122 caliber rockets. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television said at least 20 rockets were fired at Israel's military positions. Al-Minar TV said a number of the rockets targeted the Duf military base. A Lebanese security source said the rockets were launched from the area of Al-Arkoub near the Lebanese town of Sheba. Air raid sirens sounded in the Upper Galilee and in the Golan Heights, part of the territory Israel occupied in 1967. Israeli media said residents of settlements in the north of the occupied territories had been asked to stay in homes. The development came after Israeli jets struck what the regime's military claimed were sites where rockets had been launched earlier in the week.
Bombing Syria, bombing Lebanon is a way of that practice, a way of dividing new states and new communities to get legitimization for their sick political Zionist project. They try everything. They try everything to forbid building a civil state because this is their real threat to their ideology. Defending our land should not be alone through weapons and fighting, but with completing this with a political project which should be contradicted to the Sikh ideology of Zionism.
Regional resistance movements, including Palestinian Hamas and Yemeni Ansarullah, hailed their retaliatory attacks as a legitimate right against Israeli aggressions.
Israel's raids inside Lebanon were the first such attack since the 2006 war. Hezbollah says it's more capable than it was back then, and is fully prepared to stave off the Israeli aggression. Maybe that is one reason why it took responsibility for the retaliatory rocket fire. What is for certain is that Hezbollah is an effective deterrence against Israel. Take a look, please.
Lebanon's parliament speaker, Nabih Berri, said in a statement that the attacks on his country reflected the true nature of Israel. He added that the regime only understands the language of, quote, unity and resistance. President Michel Aoun also denounced the Israeli raids as a direct threat to the security and the stability of the region. Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem also said the resistance movement is committed to the principle that any aggression on Lebanon will be met with a proper response, and for this reason, it responded to the aggressive enemy with rockets. He, however, downplayed the possibility that the situation would escalate to a full-blown war.
Fragmentation of this society, or of our societies, is no less dangerous than the threat of the Zionist project. Managing its affairs, maintaining its cohesion in light of what we are experiencing is not separated from fighting the Zionist project, but it is the core of confronting it.
Israel's attacks on Lebanon's south followed the regime's similar airstrikes on Syria in recent months. The regime has recently threatened to take military action against Iran after accusing the Islamic Republic of being involved in a deadly attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman, an allegation that Tehran has denied. The Islamic Republic has called on the United Nations Security Council to confront Israel's adventurism and reject its fabrications. Tehran says Israel is trying to distract the public attention away from the regime's crimes in the region, warning that any miscalculation on the Israeli side will be met with an immediate and crushing response.
Iran slams the U.S. nuclear attack on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on the 76th anniversary of the bombardment, saying, "The event is a reminder of Washington's great crime against humanity." Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the tragedy shows that the U.S. spares no effort to reach its illegal objectives. He described nuclear weapons as a constant threat to global peace. Khatibzadeh questioned the U.S. commitment to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and nuclear disarmament. He said Washington has not only failed to take any practical step in this regard, but has also been increasingly modernizing its nuclear arsenals. Around 140,000 people died when the U.S. dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, before dropping a second bomb on Nagasaki 3 days later. Italian protesters have staged a rally in the capital, Rome, against the mandatory COVID-19 green pass.
Liberta! 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 Liberta!
The protest comes a day after the government implemented the green pass plan to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Under the program, people need to show they have received at least one COVID jab or have recently tested negative or recovered from the disease to access a range of services and venues. A similar protest was held outside the presidential palace in the Cypriot capital of Nicosia. Demonstrators expressed anger at the country's mandatory vaccination program and Green Pass plan. Cyprus and Italy are following in the footsteps of France, whose plan to curb the outbreak has also sparked protests.
Visiting the famous Eiffel Tower in Paris has become more complicated than before. Now, people have to show an electronic document that proves that they are vaccinated twice. If not, they need to show a negative PCR test. However, most of the visitors do not consider this procedure as a problem.
It's a good opportunity to show that you're vaccinated. For me, this is perfect. This way, we are all sure that we are vaccinated.
I'm fine with it. I mean, if it lets us do things like this, then why not? To go back to some kind of normal, being able to spend time with our family, go on vacation, it's nice.
The same procedure is used to visit public places like the Louvre Museum. Rows are longer than usual because people have to show their pass.
I'm rather in favor of the health pass. If it is to protect everyone and to prevent the virus from spreading, that's better for everybody.
The French Parliament and Senate have voted this new law, and earlier this week, the Constitutional Council has approved the law text. The health pass will now be extended also to restaurants and trains. But protesters continue taking the streets. They were again tens of thousands in France and at least 2,000 in Paris. Why? Jerome Rodriguez, who lost his eye in a previous protest, organized this march. He explains that the problem is not the vaccination, but the limitation of liberties.
We are here to protest against the violation and decline of liberties in France. We are not here against the vaccines. The health pass is just one extra restrictive law after another. The first restrictive law was against the Yellow Vests, the second one about global security, and now the third with the health pass. Macron should take care of the poor people, not only of the rich companies who earned a lot of money during this COVID crisis.
The protesters are especially targeting the French government that is using force rather than persuasion to obtain a double vaccination of a large majority of the French. The reason is medical. Today, most of the people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID-19 virus are not vaccinated. Most of the people who transmit the virus are not vaccinated either. Despite ongoing protests against the mandatory health pass, the majority of the French is bowing more and more to the medical evidence. Today, vaccination is the only efficient way to hold back the coronavirus. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Political analyst Mr. John Bosnitz says people in Europe no longer trust their governments or government institutions when it comes to COVID-19 and vaccination.
Well, there's a general lack of faith in government institutions, and it's not restricted to this virus issue. We have seen what is called a rebellion in the U.S. Capitol because of the elections. People just don't trust their governments. And they're also asking why it is that we were first told we needed to be vaccinated. Then we were told we needed to be vaccinated twice. Now we're being told that although you've been vaccinated twice, you can still die from the virus. We can't isolate the virus, so we cannot demonstrate what the virus is. And soon in the fall, you'll need a third vaccination. And there is a general unease, not just in France or Cyprus or Greece or in America, but around the world, that the governance of human beings is being taken out of the average man's hands. That's the issue here, a crisis in non-confidence in government structures.
Brazil has logged nearly 1,000 daily coronavirus-related deaths and over 43,000 new infections. The South American country has so far registered over 20 million cases and over 562,000 fatalities. Brazil is the world's second worst-hit nation in terms of total deaths. It also ranks the world's third in its overall reported cases. Meanwhile, Mexico announced over 20,000 new daily cases, raising the country's total caseload to nearly 3 million. According to the Mexican Health Ministry, 515 people died from the disease on Saturday. The government says the real figures are likely to be significantly higher than the official data. Tens of thousands of Argentines have taken to the streets of Buenos Aires to protest against poverty and unemployment in the country. Unemployment organizations and left-wing groups organized the protest that began in front of the government house. Similar protests were also held in other cities across the country. Latin American nation has been suffering a severe economic crisis for years, deepened by the coronavirus pandemic. On Friday, the government announced the relaxation of the COVID restrictions to reactivate the country's economy ahead of the legislative elections in November.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Vaccinating adolescents could have a significant impact on reducing transmission in schools and reduce the educational disruption that children have suffered over the past 18 months. We now present you an article written jointly by Dipti Gurdasani and John Henley. The piece is titled, Why are UK government experts holding off vaccinating under 16s in the UK? Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, JCVI, announced recently that everyone in the United Kingdom aged 16 and 17 should be offered the COVID-19 vaccine. Just several days ago, it said the vaccine wouldn't be offered to non-vulnerable people aged between 12 and 17. The change in position is welcome, but the reasons for the committee's two-week delay and its decision to not extend the vaccine to 12 to 15-year-olds are unclear. Unlike the U.S. Center for Disease Control, the CDC, the committee has offered no quantitative analysis of the risk associated with vaccinating people in this younger age group. Delaying the rollout of the vaccine to adolescents is risky. Recent figures show that 1% of 10-year-old to 19-year-olds were being diagnosed with COVID-19 a week. Waiting for further data on vaccine safety when infections are ripping through younger age groups isn't cautious, it's reckless. This seems particularly clear given what we already know about the safety of vaccines in adolescents. The UK Medicines Healthcare Products and Regulatory Authority claimed the Pfizer vaccine safe and effective for 16 and 17-year-olds in December of 2020, and stated that the benefits of this vaccine outweigh any risk when approving it for 12 to 15-year-olds in June of this year. In the United States, where officials claimed close to 9 million adolescents aged between 12 and 17 have been fully vaccinated, the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, has unambiguously recommended vaccines for those aged 12 and above. Worryingly, the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization's recent announcement that only recommended the first dose of the vaccine for 16 to 17-year-olds, millions of adolescents in this age group have been vaccinated with two doses in the United States and in other countries, and we know that full protection from the Delta variant of the coronavirus depends critically on receiving two jabs. So much data on this is already available. It's unclear why the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization needs yet more data to make an assessment that many countries made months ago. The choice in the United Kingdom now is between infection and vaccination. Given the high rates of infection among young people in the United Kingdom, there is little doubt that the benefits of vaccines far outweigh the risks. Vaccines also reduce the burden of long COVID by protecting people against infection. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, which has regularly followed up with thousands of people across the United Kingdom who have had COVID-19, finds that persistent illness is common, about 8% after infection among children. For many of those who become infected, COVID-19 is not a minor illness. Recently, the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, suggests that around 20,000 children aged under the age of 17 with long COVID currently suffer from its impact on their day-to-day lives. Some 7,000 children have been living with this for more than a year. Although only a few children may develop severe symptoms as a result of COVID-19, if thousands of children are infected, the number who become seriously ill can quickly stack up. It's puzzling that those who are nervous about vaccinating children due to the risk of extremely rare and typically minor side effects are not equally concerned about exposing children to a novel virus. We know that COVID-19 causes poorly understood multi-system long-term disease, even in young adults with mild infection, and is associated with thinning of brain gray matter. We also know it causes long-term neurological effects among hospitalized children, some of which may be permanent. High rates of infection among adolescents and younger people reflect the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, particularly in schools, where few safety measures have been put in place. Vaccinating adolescents could have a significant impact on reducing transmission in schools, reduce the educational disruption that children have suffered over the past 18 months. Reports from frontline clinicians across the globe suggest that more children are being seen in hospitals as a result of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, and that more are requiring intensive care support. Meanwhile, six European Union states have now fully inoculated a larger share of their total populations with the coronavirus vaccine than the United Kingdom, after the bloc's dire initial rollout took off, while Britain's impressive early jab rate has slumped. According to government and health service figures collated by the online science publication Our World in Data, Malta, Belgium, Spain, Portugal, Denmark, and Ireland have all overtaken the United Kingdom in terms of the percentages of their populations who are fully vaccinated. While Britain's campaign was bound to slow first as it ran into harder-to-reach, more vaccine-hesitant groups, the rate of decline is dramatic. Britain is currently administering a fraction of the daily doses of some European Union states. For example, on Wednesday, 4th of August, France administered 368,596 first doses of the vaccine and 261,695 second doses of the vaccine, while Britain's totals were 33,304 and 165,669 respectively. The data will put pressure on Boris Johnson's government to reboot a program that began supposedly as one of the world's fastest but is now flagging, with 57.3% of the population fully jabbed and 69% partly vaccinated. Vaccination rates are rising only very slowly in every age group in the United Kingdom, but low take-up in the 18 to 29 cohort, due mainly to a perception that young people are not at risk, is marked and has alarmed ministers. Among the 18 to 30-year-olds, an estimated 33% or one-third are yet to get their first shot of the vaccine. According to the figures, Malta had fully vaccinated 88% of its total population by 4th of August, with 91% having had at least one dose of the vaccine. Belgium is on 61% fully jabbed and 70% partially jabbed. Spain on 60% fully jabbed and 70% partially jabbed. Portugal on 59% and 70%. Denmark on 58% and 73%, and Ireland on 57.4% and 68%. The gap appears likely to widen further, since several European Union states, while their rollouts have also slowed since June, are still administering both first and second doses significantly faster than the United Kingdom, whose first dose rate in particular has plummeted. The Netherlands is already ahead of the United Kingdom on first doses, while others, including France, are on course on current trends to overtake Britain on second doses shortly. According to Our World in Data, the European Union's 27 rolling 7-day average of daily doses per 100 people is currently 0.56 shots, almost double the UK's rate of 0.28 shots. Some European Union states are vaccinating faster than the bloc's average, and many times faster than Britain. For example, Denmark is managing a rolling 7-day average of 0.97 daily doses per 100 people, France 0.82, Belgium 0.80, Portugal and Ireland 0.77, Spain 0.73 and Italy 0.72. With the rapid spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus adding a new urgency to its slowing vaccine drive, France is one of several European Union countries to have adopted the kind of coercive tactics aimed at boosting take-up among vaccine-shy groups, including young people, that the British government has so far appeared reluctant to consider. Denmark, Italy, Greece and most recently Germany have all adopted or mooted similar tough incentives to get vaccinated, while multiple European Union countries have also boosted take-up by opening up their vaccination offer to all over 12-year-olds, some since mid-June. In March, as Britain's vaccine rollout powered ahead, the World Health Organization, WHO, compared its unfavorable with Europe's, which is criticized as unacceptably slow. However, success is far from even across the bloc. Poorer member states such as Romania and Bulgaria, with less well-endowed public health services than wealthier neighbors such as Germany and the Netherlands, are struggling, with barely 26% and 15% of their respective populations vaccinated with at least one dose of the vaccine.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio with a smiling face, we have Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So we've entered into a new phase of media censorship. The Western media has a long track record of actually censoring the voice of the revolution, the voice of Iran, the voice of the Islamic Republic, the voice of people anywhere, everywhere, who speak out against the system anyway. But now we've actually entered a phase where they've seized the websites of Press TV and Al Masira and Al Alam and other such channels out there. Now, this is a little bit strange. This actually shows us that the enemy is more on edge, it seems, than ever was before. The election of Sayyid Raisi may have a big part to play in this. I'd like to get your opening thoughts on this entire thing. I think Sheikh Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is nothing new, like you pointed out in your opening statement. When we look at the track record of the Western hegemonic governments and their affiliated apparatus, right? Even, you know, I would go to a point where the United Nations and other so-called international organizations, they're part of that whole strategy and that whole plan. They have been silencing the word of logic, the word of rationality, the word of tolerance, the word of exposing the evil and standing up and resisting against the evil. Mm-hmm. This is nothing new. It has been going on throughout the history, even before this electronic media existed, right? If you look at the history, back in the day too, they would silence people from talking about and bringing up the realities of this world, right? Mm-hmm. So this is nothing new. Now, why is it happening now? Again, like you pointed out, I think the enemy, you know, they've realized that they're losing on the propagation and propaganda field as well. For instance, one of the examples, just to elaborate on this point, you look at the anti-Israel sentiment in the entire world. Right, especially the Western countries, right, where they praised back in the day, they praised the Zionist regime, and you know, in the name of human rights and so on and so forth, and rights for Jewish people and so on and so forth. Now, if you go and talk to those people, because I've been in touch, right, 10, 15 years ago, the anti-Israel sentiment was very insignificant. 15 years
and
ago.
It was limited to kind of clusters of very, activist groups,
exactly.
And Muslims,
exactly.
Some
and,
Muslims.
And non-Muslims so. Too. It was very very contained, right? It was not the mainstream narrative. Now, fast forwarding, especially after the social media and, you know, the officers of the software that are out there The way they have raised the information level and the facts that they have presented and the logical discourses that they have presented, it has compelled many people out there, especially in the West. I keep saying West because I know in America, you know, when I used to read anytime there's a news report about Palestine or Israel in one of the mainstream news outlets, I used to read comments. You know, I think you all do every once in a while, you know, just to see what's going on, how are people. Well, back in the day, 15 years ago maybe, you would hardly find maybe one or two people exposing the crimes of the Zionist regime, right? Most of the people, they were, like I pointed out, they were supportive in one way or the other. But now if you go on any of these news, now the news channels have to delete those comments.
Yeah, often they'll say comments are not allowed.
Right? Why are they doing it? Because they're losing on that battlefield as well, and it has changed the perception of the people of the world, the general masses of the world.
I'm going to want to come back to this, but Sayed Mehdi, so Sheikh Ali pointed out how previously, if you go 10, 15 years back, the negative sentiments towards Israel were lower than they are today. And we talked about how the activists and those small clusters of groups that existed back then who were pro-Palestine, they were contained back then, and now it's not so contained. Now, my question to you is, these groups obviously did a lot of propagation, they did lots of work, they created posters, they held up banners, they went to the protests and all those kinds of things. To what extent do you feel that they have had an impact on the wider audiences out there?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's a very good point, it's a very solid point that even a small group of people, if they are dedicated, if they remain steadfast, if they believe in their cause and their cause is a just cause, it might take a little bit of time, but surely they will overcome and they will be victorious even upon a larger host. Taking it from a very general, you know, in my own words perspective, which I put forth, but if you look at the Holy Quran, it says the same thing, right? That how many a small host has overcome a very large host. And what is the differentiating factor? It's not weapons and power and money and these kind of things. It's remaining steadfast, remaining on the correct path, being patient in the adversity, continuing to move forward, and fighting for a just cause. These small groups, you know, back in the day, were fighting a huge propaganda machinery, which was being pushed by the Zionist powers and pro-Zionist lobbies. I mean, even today, these Zionist lobbies are humongous. And the fact that they're losing this propaganda war or this war of information is really, I think, one, humiliating for them, despite
all those resources that they have at their disposal.
I mean, yeah, the resources, the amount of global leaders that are in their pockets, you know.
The government supporting them.
The central banks that these people.
The intimidation, let's not forget that as well. The intimidation, the police forces are on their side. The system is actually on their side, and yet.
And despite all this, you find that this small group of people who were standing up for the just cause of Palestine, and the cause of Palestine itself is just, just go and read the history about it. They stood up, they stayed steadfast, and you have seen that the tide has turned. And now, more so than in solidarity of the Zionist state, the world is now in solidarity with the people of Palestine.
So coming back to Sheikh Ali, this idea of them having lost, essentially, the soft war, at least the previous battles, they've lost them. Are we saying that that's the main factor and cause in why they are censoring these predominantly Shia media
course,
outlets?
Of course, if you look at the enemy, they don't want the masses to, you know, wake up, right? That's one of the agendas of the mainstream media, to keep them in slumber, keep them sleeping, you know, just be irrelevant in this whole equation of, you know, truth versus falsehood and righteousness versus falsehood, the haq and batil. They want them to be just indifferent, right? Just focus on your own life, because it goes with their whole philosophy of life and the outlook they have towards the world and the life, where they say that you're a social animal who should only be concerned with your own needs and wants. You know, just stay there and no need. While when you look at Islam, for instance, or even human logic, right? We cannot be indifferent about a person dying on the street. We cannot be indifferent about, you know, a pregnant woman not reaching the hospital. We cannot be indifferent about a neighbor who is suffering, right?
It's this just is the true human definition of a social life.
Right.
Their definition is a contradiction, as you
right.
said.
So what these media outlets, you know, especially the ones who are banned, I don't know about all of them because I haven't really studied all of them, but at least a few I know of, which were news reporting websites and satellite channels, they are banned because due to their activities and because what they were putting out there, and they were informing people, the masses were waking up, waking up against oppression, waking up against tyranny, waking up against these control that the Western hegemonic governments have had over them for decades, if not centuries, right? They were waking up to the reality of so-called liberal democracy, you know, the last 200 years phenomena. You know, it's just like a hoax, you know, where people were made to believe that you have a say, you have a right. You don't have right, you don't have say, you don't have freedom of expression, you don't have freedom of speech in the West. You look at the academics who were not even Muslims, right? In some cases, they were Jewish people, right? These academics, their careers were ruined because they exposed the Western treachery and their plots, and especially the evil nature of the Zionist regime of Israel, right? Their academic careers were destroyed. Well, he's a teacher, he's a professor, right? Norman Finkelstein, for instance, you know, so on and so forth. There are too many of them, right? It's just one example.
And even people who weren't associated with the idea of Palestine, so to speak, but people like Julian Assange, who were just pointing out that, look, the flaws of the Western imperialistic system, even they're imprisoned.
Right. Now they're feeling vulnerable. Now the West is feeling vulnerable. They've put together something over the course of last 200 years, which is called the liberal democracy and its affiliated apparatus. They're feeling that it's vulnerable. People are not going to get tricked into and take it as at its face value. People are standing up, challenging that system, right? You saw, like, even with the so-called democracy, how people opposed the elected government and the Trump era and the transition to Biden. You saw that, right?
Fiasco. The storming of the Capitol is a huge historical event.
Right? So now they're seeing that we are weak. They're seeing that the masses are waking up. They're seeing that it is not that we can just put out a multi-million-dollar news reporting website or a TV channel or a satellite channel, and the masses will be fooled that easily.
Or even that the movies that they make are going to completely, put out their propaganda. Exactly. You know, you have superhero movies presenting the American military as the good guys and stuff. Right. So people are even waking up to the cracks
now
in that.
Now, the question is, connecting it back to your question, with all this in mind, who made it all happen? How did the masses wake up? It is because of projects like Press TV. It is because of projects like Al Alam. It is because of projects like Al Masira, right? These are the projects which are run by human beings, not by robots. Like, their setups are being run by, you know, the machine-built artificial intelligence-based censorship and all that. No, these are human beings who are interacting with other people. And when that sentiment gets put out there in form of news, it has an effect on people. And because they were being effective in exposing the plots of the tyrants and the oppressive governments, they are silenced. Because that's all the West can do. They just know how to silence others, right? Sometimes countries, sometimes governments, sometimes media channels, sometimes. Look at the crackdown that happened on social media profiles right after the martyrdom of Shahid Qasem Soleimani, right? People who had established profiles, 10 years, 12 years old profiles, they were wiped off their platforms.
Yes.
From Facebook, from Twitter, from YouTube, from Instagram, you know, so on and so forth. Now what we're seeing, this recent wave, is targeting those channels which are on satellite. So when it comes to social media, many of these channels of spreading the truth, they were removed. Now it's the turn of the satellite channels, Press TV and Al-Masira and Al-Alam and all that.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately. A fascinating discussion, inshallah, which we will be continuing, inshallah, next time. From myself and from our honorable guests, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature. It's taken my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today. Yeah, Allah.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Early in the pandemic, in the scramble to create tools to study SARS-CoV-2, investigators developed pseudovirus systems to measure infection in a safe, easily quantifiable way. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Heiren Cho and Michael Farzan, researchers. This article is published under the heading How SARS-CoV-2 First Adapted in Humans. Stay tuned for more. Viruses need entry proteins to penetrate the cells where they will replicate. The severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2 SARS-CoV-2 version is called the spike or S protein. The S protein, also target of the current vaccines, is quickly adapting to its new human host. It took its first major step in this direction early in 2020 when its amino acid 614 changed from an aspartic acid to a glycine. Viruses bearing this D614 G mutation transmit among humans more rapidly and now form the majority in circulation. Early in the pandemic, in the scramble to create tools to study SARS-CoV-2, investigators developed pseudovirus systems to measure infection in a safe, easily quantifiable way. These systems express a viral entry protein on the surface of a reporter virus used to monitor cell entry and have been used for years to study many such proteins, including the S protein of classic SARS-CoV-1. frustratingly, pseudoviruses built from the SARS-CoV-2S protein produce much lower signals than those based on the very similar SARS-CoV-1S protein. This was perplexing because biochemical studies of SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2S protein receptor binding domains RBDs made clear that the SARS-CoV-2 RBD bound their common receptor angiotensin converting enzyme 2 with higher affinity than that of SARS-CoV-1. Faced with inefficient assays, many virologists landed on the same solution as their structural biology colleagues. Mutate the S protein site that is cleaved by ferrin-like proteases in virus-producing cells. This change kept the S protein S1 domain, which contains the RBD and binds ACE2, covalently linked to its S2 domain, which anchors the S protein to the virion. Notably, some but not all of these ferrin site mutations significantly improved pseudovirus infection of cells. This fix solved a technical problem, but it deepened a mystery. Although a number of distantly related coronaviruses carry ferrin cleavage sites at their S1, S2 boundaries, the SARS-CoV-1 S protein and those of all known bat-derived viruses from the same SARB virus lineage lack this site. Instead of being cleaved in virus-producing cells, their S proteins are cleaved by different proteases while the virus is engaging ACE2 in the next yet-to-be-infected cell. As it happened, ferrin site mutations that improved SARS-CoV-2 S protein function in pseudoviruses allowed the modified S protein to work with these later-stage enzymes, just like the SARS-CoV-1 version. Why then did the SARS-CoV-2 ferrin site persist, even though it made infection in cell culture less efficient? Indeed, viruses passaged in culture regularly lost this site. Does it somehow improve viral transmission? Would it eventually disappear over the course of the pandemic? In the summer of 2020, Korber et al. Sounded an alarm about a mutation of concern, namely D614G. In the lab, this change obviated the need to eliminate the S protein ferrin site, apparently correcting a design flaw associated with this unusual cleavage site. Animal studies with otherwise identical viruses showed markedly greater replication of the D614G variant in the upper respiratory tract, a site important for transmission. By contrast, no significant differences between the two viruses were seen in the lower respiratory tract, a site responsible for more severe disease. These observations are consistent with the current consensus that D614G, now present in most circulating viruses, enhances viral transmission, but unlike more recent acquired transmissions in S1, it does not change the rate of hospitalizations. The underlying mechanism for this fitness advantage remained a point of controversy. Here, a second unusual property of the S protein, in this case shared with SARS-CoV-1, became relevant. The SARS-CoV-2 S protein, like most interproteins of viruses, with a lipid membrane, assembles into trimers. Typically, during the process of virion assembly, viral entry proteins subtly change their confrontations. But it is unusual for these proteins to break their threefold symmetry before they bind their receptor. However, the mature SARS-CoV-2S protein often assumes an asymmetrical arrangement whereby one of its three RBDs assumes an open or up conformation. Only RBDs in this up conformation can bind ACE2. Once it does so, the S1 domain dissociates from S2, and S2 undergoes a pronounced rearrangement to a post-fusion state. The release energy of this rearrangement drives the viral and cell membranes to fuse and gives the virus access to the cell interior. To explain the 614G fitness, some investigators focus on the impact of the 614G on the frequency with which this one-up conformation could be found, suggesting that more efficient engagement of the receptor accounted for the enhanced transmissibility of viruses bearing this mutation. Other scientists noted that S proteins of the 614G expressing viruses fell apart less frequently, an effect perhaps amplified in the challenging environment of a living organism. They observed that the 614G helped the S1 domain cling to S2, preventing S2 from prematurely and unproductively assuming its post-fusion conformation. Thus, the virus had more functional S proteins that could bind and infect the next cell. To cut through this controversy, Zhang, the expert in this domain, solved the structure and provided detailed analysis of both the 614 and G614 S proteins in multiple states. They first noted that as they and others had previously observed, the loss of the 614 in S1 breaks an ionic bond to a proximal lysine, K854 in S2. Loss of this salt bridge is initially counterintuitive because it will loosen the association between S1 and S2, although it might ease the movement of the RBD into the up configuration. However, the structures from Zhang et al. Show that a major difference between S proteins with and without D614G is the visibly greater ordering in G614S proteins of a region spanning residence 602 to 640, which authors call the 630 loop. This loop is just downstream of G614.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.